Hey there, lovely listeners. Now, you will know that we are partway through our series, Forensically Deconstructing Jeffrey Epstein, and we still have much more to say about that case. But we also wanted to cover a fantastic five-hour docu-series, which is called The Preppy Murder, Death in Central Park, which is about the murder of Jennifer Levin. Now, Jennifer was 18 at the time when she was found dead underneath a tree in Central Park on August 26, 1986. And The Preppy Murder, Death in Central Park, really places her voice at the centre of her own narrative. And it will air over three consecutive nights from Wednesday, November the 13th to Friday, November the 15th at 9 p.m. ET on both AMC and Sundance TV. Now, Lisa and I had a brilliant opportunity to sit down with Robert Friedman, CEO of Bungalow Media and Entertainment, who has brought this to our screens. And it really is an interesting story in terms of why he felt it was important to retell this story and why now. I think you're going to really enjoy this interview. And unfortunately, Jim wasn't able to be with us on this interview. He was in transit. So we have made a decision that we are going to forensically deconstruct this case because it is such an important story to tell, with Jennifer's narrative right at the centre of it. And just to say, you may hear another little voice on the podcast, and that is of the savage little beast, Queen Bee, my little golden doodle pup who decided to have her voice heard. So she is in the background, and we wanted to just keep the flow of the conversation natural. So we continued on, but I don't think it distracts too much. It shows we are human, and it's real life, real cases, real people, and real pups. So let us know what you think about the interview and about the case of Jennifer Levin. You can hit us up on social media, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And without further ado, here is our interview with Robert Friedman.
The amount of press that was at this trial from all over the world.
Before O.J. Simpson, the preppy killer, was the trial of the century.
He killed her in cold blood with his bare hands.
This narrative has become something completely different than what it was. Robert is a symbol of white male beauty and money.
The news made it seem like she was the one to blame.
You still see this being played out today.
The media were on like Team Robert Chambers, even though he'd killed her.
This story has never been told.
Hello, lovely listeners, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and executive producer of a new true crime documentary that's animated called Jennifer 42. And today I'm joined by a very special guest who is
Bobby Friedman. I'm the CEO of Bungalow Media and Entertainment and the executive producer of the Preppy Murder miniseries that will be on AMC and on Sundance.
And I am Lisa Zambetti, casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, and I'm so happy that Bobby can join us. This is a really special interview for a very special miniseries that we know our listeners will love to catch.
I just wanted to say that actually you're an Emmy Award winning producer, no less, and also that you've had various nominations for Best Documentary regarding Paradise Lost 3 Purgatory, which is about the murders of Stevie Branch, Christopher Byers, and Michael Moore, the West Memphis case, which we've also covered on Real Crime Profile. So,
oh, great.
You did a fantastic job on that. And that's why, again, we're just super excited about this particular case. I do think it's such an important story to retell. Why was it important to you, and how did the project come about?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I grew up in New York, and I was at the time in 1986, I was working at MTV. I was part of the startup of MTV, but I had grown up in New York. So you couldn't be living in New York at that time without hearing all about this case for a bunch of reasons. Number one, it was on the front page of the newspapers every single day for probably 3 months that the investigations were going on and the trial was going on. And then it was the lead story on every one of the news services. And for those of your listeners and viewers who don't know this, at that time, there weren't that many cable outlets that would really be directed toward these kinds of storytelling. So it was really the network broadcasters at the time that talked about this. And to be perfectly honest, it was really a coming of age place. I mean, this was a bar that was named Dorian's Red Hand. Many of the bars at that time were named after men. One was Mike Malkin's, another one was Don Denton's. For those of you who grew up in New York or frequented it. So we were all very familiar with this establishment. And when this happened, we were all very, very shocked that this could happen on the Upper East Side. These kids at the greatest moment of their life when they're leaving high school and going off to college the next day. So it was certainly in your face, something that we had all grown up with. Subsequent to this, I had gone to Vassar College. And for those of you who don't know, Vassar was a predominantly female college. It was the women's school, if you will, of Yale. I went there and I ended up being on the board of Vassar College with Linda Fairstein, who was also on the board of Vassar and had attended Vassar College. And this was a case that she had prosecuted at the time. So I've always really wanted to tell this story, but probably in a different way than in the ways it was told.
And we're going to come back to Linda. And for our listeners who are not familiar with this case, a little bit of background. Jennifer Levin was 18 years old and she was found dead underneath a tree in Central Park on August the 26th, 1986. So this was the time of heightened crime in the 80s, wasn't it, in New York? And we've covered numerous cases at that time. So we know that, you know, crime was three times higher than what it had been. So although the docu does talk about the glorious 80s, of course, there's the aspect of crime being high, and particularly when someone is found dead in Central Park and it's a white girl or a white female.
Yeah, well, you know, it's very insightful. I mean, the 80s were a time when you wouldn't recognize, and I think when you take a look at the miniseries, you see how we've sort of captured, if you will, this period of time that looks nothing like New York right now by any means. And as a matter of fact, in a lot of the recrees that we've done, we take a look at what New York looks like because we dressed it up. Plus the archival of New York at that time is just mind blowing. You know, Right. Going on a subway that is totally fraught with
graffiti
and everything else around the sun. So that was another intriguing part of this. I have to say that for me personally, when I identified this as a story for us to do at Bungalow, it was really primarily because I don't think that any of the docs or the films that had been done really addressed the assault on the memory, if you will, of Jennifer Levin. It was really told in a very different way, and it became such a big part of the DNA of the story about women at that time and sexual violence that it was particularly intriguing to me to be able to tell a different story.
Absolutely. And I think that the case itself is one that is shocking because on the face of it, it looked quite straightforward. To the homicide detectives who built the sequence of events and realized that she'd been at Dorian's, and you've referenced that bar, and then working back of who was she with. And then they go and interview Robert Chambers and they see that his home address, as he gets out of bed, he's got scratches all over his face. And although he tells one story down at the station, which he voluntarily says that he would go down there without a lawyer, he then starts to tell a different story. He admits that he did it. And so for the detectives, they think it's relatively straightforward. But of course, the case isn't straightforward because a number of other protagonists emerge. And those protagonists, to me, are the media, and we'll talk about that, but also his lawyer, the criminal defense lawyer at the time, Jack Lippman, and the criminal justice system. And I think these rough sex defenses, we've seen quite a few of them in the UK, but this was in the 80s. And it was really shocking in many senses because you saw the misogyny and the sexism played out in the media where she is blamed for her own death.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that. I mean, when you take a snapshot of this, and not to be a spoiler of the end, but many people, or probably most of your audience, thinks that they really know what was going on. It was a simple case. You know that someone was murdered. You may or may not know that there was a plea bargain where there was a 5 to 15 year sentence for what was a manslaughter charge instead of a murder charge or murder conviction at the end, which we can get into in a second. What people don't know is why this happened and how the media played a role in this. And the fact that, not unlike OJ, and I would argue that until OJ, this was clearly the probably biggest case that was out in the media. And you say to yourself, it's amazing. Here was a day before these kids are going off to college. The world believed that he was guilty, yet he got 5 to 15. He served actually 15, came out, and was put back in jail for drug charges for another 19 years. To your point about the judicial system, there's something wrong in a judicial system when someone serves 5 to 15 for this kind of a crime and then goes back in for drug charges. It reminds me a bit of OJ, which is he served a far less severe sentence up front, and then for stealing back his memorabilia, yeah, went back in there for 20 plus years. So there are some similarities. But yes, the biggest challenge in this case was really, in my opinion, twofold. It occurred at a time when this Me Too movement did not exist. And you ask why 20-something years later we'd be revisiting this. And probably, if I were being honest, is that so many of the things that were issues then are still issues today. Clearly, as a country and as a community, we've certainly made progress. I don't know if you know this, but Linda's group, if you will, it was the first time that there was a sex crimes prosecution unit in the United States, meaning that the way that they would investigate these crimes was very different than what you see on SVU, with a woman, with the kinds of processes and procedures involved. There were very few women prosecutors who had even prosecuted a murder case. Linda was certainly one of the first to actually do that. And we were living at a time when the media was so anxious to generate usage. And we think now about what's going on with social media and with fake news and everything else. But no one could have grown up in New York City without seeing, or even in the country, without seeing Robert Chambers, the preppy murder, on the front page. It's beautiful. He was almost like an Adonis, dressed up as he was a preppy, thinking that this was a guy who went to all these good schools and went to all this other stuff and lived in this world of privilege without really knowing what he was really like.
Yeah.
And that was another big thing that was occurring at the time. The inadmissibility of certain kinds of evidence certainly led to some kind of a deal being made.
I met Jennifer in 1984. We worked together in Soho at French Connection. She was this kind of starry-eyed, you know, young teenager coming from Long Island. To live in Soho in the early 80s was a big deal. The streets were dark. There was people living in raw lofts with no one around, and it was not gussied up the way it is now. Her father ran this real estate company, and Jennifer was the downtown kid. And there was a kind of fast friendship.
Can I just say that what struck me about your documentary is your access to Jennifer's friends? Because I thought I knew a lot about this case, and just them opening up about her story, her background, who she was, how she met Robert. I just didn't know any of that. And boy, when you get Jessica Doyle on that screen, you know, she is such an advocate for her
friend. Amazing.
Yeah,
yes.
It's just fantastic. And a lot of us have an image of New York Studio 54 and all that with like Halston and Liza and adults. Yes. We had no idea of the kind of things that the children were into, and that they were having such extensive partying, sure, and their lives were like that too. Well, amazing.
You bring up a great point. I mean, I should say that in addition to the characters that all wanted to speak up, primarily because they were either friends in that group and really wanted to finally come forward in a way that hadn't been done, or because Jennifer's mom, Ellen, who I would argue is also just a terrible victim, one of many kinds of victims, which I think is important here. But the archival from the case, the taped confessions that really had never been before seen the way that we documented them, the documents of the case, some of which had come from the police, and some of which came from the DA's office. Some of this stuff that had never been admissible in the past that we could talk about in the first person was pretty amazing. The participation in this, I think that everyone really wanted to step up in ways that hadn't been done. Secondly, you know, the two directors that I brought on, you know, Annie Sundstrom and Ricky, who are two fabulous directors. As a matter of fact, they had done Reversing Roe. They had done the Boston Marathon tragedy. They're just wonderful storytellers. Interestingly enough, Ricky had actually been going to school in New York City to a girls' prep school and actually was sort of, I guess I should say, hung out with that crowd, if you will. Mm-hmm. She was in Robert's little black book, though there are always black books that have names in them that are, you know, that for other reasons. But she was very aware, and a lot of the young women that you're mentioning and some of the men were sort of in this crowd that Ricky hung out with. So myself, and I was probably 10 years older, living in New York and living through this and still walking by Dorian's Red Hand to this day, right, and imagineering what had gone on was interesting. But you mentioned something really interesting about the time. This was a time, if you lived in an urban area like New York, where we were all kind of latchkey kids. I say proudly, on the one hand, my mom got out of college and worked, and she was the editor of a wide array of magazines. My dad was a doctor. I lived on the Upper East Side. On Friday night, when I was 16 years old, went to a little prep school, I would go to these bars, you know, whether they be Dorian's or whether they be Malkin's. And as latchkey kids, our parents kind of thought, you know, and not all parents, mind you, but they kind of thought, you know, my kids were safe there.
Yeah.
They could go. They didn't have to drive like my friends in the suburbs. And this was pre-designated driver times. So it was a place that you would go and you would congregate and you would see your friends. And your parents really felt it was safe. It was interesting. I remember once years ago talking about this for a story that we had done when I was at MTV, and talking about how the guy who owned the bar or the woman that owned the bar would make sure we got into a cab and got home in the evening. So there was kind of a safety net in this, or so we thought. In the way it happened.
Well, yeah, the monster didn't come from out of nowhere. The monster came from within your group.
Well, the key thing was the monster didn't look like the monster, which is everything about what my work is about, unpeeling the masks that people have. And of course, he was 6'4", 190 pounds, very good looking. You mentioned Adonis-esque, and yes, you know, was put on the cover of newspapers, dressed in his blazer, looking like this preppy, where of course, that wasn't who he was. His mother worked for the elite, but that wasn't his world, and he was trying to access that world. So I think what you do very clearly is show, actually, on the face of it, that he presents as one thing. And I was fascinated to watch those interviews. I had never seen them before, of just how calm and confident this young man was being questioned by homicide detectives. He just seemed unflappable and so confident in his account that even listening to the account, you know, having worked at New Scotland Yard and having run the homicide prevention unit, been involved in interviewing many people, it's clear that what he said could not have happened, even in the way that he demonstrated it. But just how cool and calm and collected he was really quite staggering to see.
It's interesting that you put it that way, because we talk about these victims and you mentioned Robert's mother. I would probably argue that she too was a victim in that she really tried. As a matter of fact, as a little unknown fact, she had worked for the Hammersteins of Rodgers and Hammerstein, whose grandson was my best friend in high school.
Oh, really?
And she took care of his grandma. She was a very devout Christian who was very active in the church. And all she wanted for her Robert, despite the fact that the tactics were probably not only inappropriate, but ineffective, obviously, all she wanted for him was to be a part of this group. I would argue, except for, and I don't want to be a spoiler in this series, once you get into episode 3 and beyond, you see some of the things that Robert's doing, and we talk about some of his past, but you could see how this guy could fool a lot of folks. I mean, he was enchanting. He was seductive. So you sort of feel for his mom, who had to live through this as well, in a very different way.
Absolutely. And did you reach out to his mother and to him to see whether they would participate?
We did. And we reached out, as a matter of fact, we reached out to Robert in jail and we got no response to his. We gave him the opportunity to participate. Most of the folks, either friends of Robert's or friends of Jennifer and obviously family, agreed to participate. There was an example in one case where one of the participants really didn't want to be identified. Since this case is still on the minds of people and people are kind of afraid for whatever the reasons.
And his mother didn't want to participate either. She didn't.
No.
It would have been interesting to have heard her perspective of, I call it the psychological autopsy, go back to the very beginnings. But, and this seemed to be a young man who at no point had been held to account. And that's
yes.
what we see with, you know, when people get away with things, they just become more and more confident.
Is Jack Lipman still alive, the defense attorney? I saw
no.
he was on his
Jack own. Lipman died a few years ago of cancer. Unfortunately, Mike Sheehan also just recently passed away of cancer, who was the lead detective.
Oh my gosh, I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, it was within the last 2 months, and Steve Dunleavy from Current Affair has passed on. They were very concerned about making sure that this kind of a story was told. And Ellen and her other daughter, you know, Ellen, who at the time was a single mom, as you know from the series, who's obviously never gotten over this. The great news for Ellen of the good things that have occurred out of this is that she was very active over the last decade in trying to make some of the rape shield laws, which would prevent them from bringing into evidence some of the past sexual behavior of women who have lived through this and have gone through this and whose memory is at stake. So it's wonderful that there are some of these good things that have come out, yet certainly not enough.
Absolutely. I mean, she was incredible in the docuseries, just so poised and articulate and intelligent and emotive. She really did capture my heart in the way that she described not only what happened to Jennifer, her beloved daughter, but what happened at the point of the trial, which really was the worst part to her, of having to sit there and listen to her daughter being made out to be someone that she just was not.
Right. They treated her daughter as a criminal. Lipman was an amazing litigator. As a matter of fact, one of the things that came out as a part of this series is, it was interesting to think back at this time, but not surprising that he certainly had, from what we've heard from Linda, eyes for Linda, and thought it would be great that there would be this attractive, smart woman working on this case that he could, quote, hang out with. And as a matter of fact, there's a piece of archival that he had sent her a note to that effect. Looking forward to working with you on this case, as opposed to the first assistant DA who you see in the initial interrogation. So this was a time that was just so different, if not for, I believe, the Me Too movement at this point and creating the context that exists today, we probably could not tell this story in such a convincing way as hopefully we have.
Yeah, I mean, so powerful. And I really want to thank you for putting Jennifer's voice at the very center of it.
Mm-hmm.
Hearing about who she was, you know, how bright she was and how popular and how social and smart and how much she loved life. And hearing her actually as a person rather than the body, which is what Robert Chambers calls her in his interview. And then all the other media slurs where
yes.
she is defamed and defiled. I really like the way that you did that. And Jessica, I do agree with Lisa. She was just phenomenal in giving us the context. And her anger was very clear of she probably hasn't spoken out before. And I think that now in the Me Too era, we need to hear more from people who have gone through situations like this and really retelling the story in the correct narrative. And I think that you have really done that. And I'm glad that you brought two female directors in.
Mm-hmm.
To assist, because I do think women see different things in stories like this to men. And I was so happy to see that you had acknowledged that, as had others, in telling this story.
Yes. And you know, one of the things that we're hoping that this Me Too moment in time, if you will help destroy the narrative, if you will, of her life that has really lived from then until now. To live through these kinds of interviews, and we're working with Ricky and Annie on the Jeffrey Epstein series for Lifetime as well.
I was going to ask you about that because we are in the middle of covering that case in particular.
My colleagues at Bungalow Joe tease me that for the last year and a half, we've worked on corruption and crime and abuse, and this has been our lives. We did the Panama Papers a year ago. That was a pay TV series that we put out theatrically. We worked on the Preppy murder, obviously, and we're starting to do the Epstein series. And, you know, what's interesting about these, and I think you started when we first started talking, you said, God, everyone kind of thinks that they know what happened. This started out, I don't know if you know this, as a four-part miniseries for Sundance. And as we got into the story and we were able, and this really goes to Annie and Ricky's success in being able to pull this off, we were peeling back the layers of each of these characters in the story itself. And we were able to get a fifth episode. We had so much stuff to really understand what was going on. And there were surprises in this. Some of the surprises were personal and some, you know, in terms of the story itself. I can't help but remembering this image of the courtroom and seeing the clergy sitting in the front row of the trial for the entire time. And we were sitting there saying, what was going on? Now, we did know that Robert's mom was very active in the church, but we didn't know that someone named Teddy McCarrick had actually written the bail letter. Teddy McCarrick at the time was in Newark. He was the Bishop of Newark, the senior clergy member in Newark, in the city of Newark, and wrote that letter. And we all know, as a result of the last few months of what's gone on with the church, that McCarrick has been defrocked and is out of the church at this point. And, you know, you can't help but wonder, and we don't go into, because we don't have any evidence one way or the other of what had happened, nor are we looking for any excuses for the kinds of behavior that existed. But, you know, it does beg you to believe that when you take a look at that moment in time, the 80s, and what was going on, this was a story that hit on every single interesting part of a decade. It was about sex. It was about privilege. It was about male privilege and beauty and the way people worked. And it was about the church. And given that whole context, you wonder what would be happening today if this were going on today. And I shudder to think that in the Epstein series, which is why it was of such interest to me, over the last decade, perhaps not much has changed, or not enough has changed, I should say. And that's why we're really very interested in telling the story. And similarly, there will be a bunch of series coming out and films coming out and scripted series coming out on Epstein. But for us, we really want to give a voice to the survivors of that horrific period of time. So we think it's kind of similar to what we did with this.
My dad used to say to me, it's a 1% chance that anything horrible is going to go wrong. And then the 1% happened.
When you reference the little black book, I felt that you were referencing, obviously, with Epstein, there was a little black book too. We've been forensically deconstructing the case on Real Crime Profile. And of course, the case is still ongoing. Mm-hmm. There are investigations still happening, and we are naming many of the enablers and the conspirators and the co-defenders. And so it's a case that really does peel back the layers, where you can see, probably for the first time, the people behind the curtain, as I call it, who are making things go away, disappearing charges or lessening charges. And that ecosystem is something that I have a very clear lens on. And the same with the criminal justice system in Jennifer's case, you know, of how a victim who was brutalized, because when you realize the extent of her injuries and the fact that she had a bulging eye socket and that she had bruises all over her body, she had defense injuries, and she really fought for her life. And yet, here you hear a 6'4" guy, 190 pounds, claim to two homicide detectives that she was raping him.
Right.
He pushed her off of him, and then suddenly she was dead. Well, her injuries didn't corroborate his version of events. That was his narrative. That was
then you had a judicial system that would not allow into evidence DNA, though it was in the nascent stages of DNA investigation. That's absurd. Or wouldn't allow in the previous behavior. They allowed in her previous sexual behavior. God forbid that a woman should like to be with other partners, but wouldn't allow in the fact that he was a burglar, that he had stolen from his friends, that he had done all of this horrific stuff. It's just crazy.
Mind-boggling.
Yeah. It's the double standard, and we still see that double standard now. And again, with the documentary, you peel back the layers on the fact that, as you mentioned, the burglaries, how prolific he was, but also all the other women. And the 16-year-old, then Alex Cappell, you managed to get her to talk on the documentary. And I would imagine how conflicting. She was 16 years of age at the time. He was 21. So again, you see this power imbalance. But how conflicting for her. And I'm so glad she spoke out and she had the opportunity to.
And she was so articulate. And when she talked, when she went back to see him when he had come out, and she was shaking, you could almost feel her fear as a viewer, in an amazing way. And I'm so thrilled because this was tough for these people to come back and talk, no matter who they were. It was a very difficult thing to do. So.
It really was. But I think the way that you've done it, I think they'd be very pleased with the outcome, because it really does center the narrative as it should do in the right way. And it going to 5 episodes, I think, is fascinating. You would think, how much could there be to tell viewers about this story? But it is just like peeling layer after layer after layer, exposing the system and all the protagonists, the parts that people played, and giving her mother and her sister an opportunity to really speak from the heart. I just think Ellen is incredible. The fact that she's changed law, I think it's 10 times.
Yes.
Already to protect victims. And she's used this really in Jennifer's name as a force for good. And it's so powerful.
We're hoping that there was some closure as a result of this series. Having said that, on August 26, 2024, he comes out of jail. August 26, 2024, I think that's the exact date. But he comes out of jail for the drug charges, and it's going to be really interesting to see, particularly after seeing him in the light of some of the footage that we were able to include in the series that had not been found or admissible prior or was newly discovered. So we think that this will certainly, within the context of this year, just create a vision of what had happened and all the travesties surrounding it. And come back to some justice that's necessary. Yeah.
There's so much new information that you put forth. But listeners, if you think you know this story, I thought I knew this story. Boy, was I in for a shock at all the things that you disclosed. So it's amazing that on the day that August 26th is when he killed her, August 26th, 2024, he'll be released. That's the ultimate in irony. I mean, that's insane.
Thank you for giving this the kind of coverage and in-depth thinking that we hope are in creating a discussion about this, because we don't think that our job is done with this. And certainly we're thrilled that AMC and Sundance are going to be simulcasting this starting on Wednesday, which is the first time that that's ever been done. And I think that goes in part to the importance of this story and wanting it to be sort of broadly distributed. So we're thrilled to death that that's going to be the outcome.
That's fantastic. And I know Elliot Goldberg as well. He was very keen to tell this story, as he knew Jennifer, didn't he? He
went to camp. Elliot had actually gone to summer camp, and I'm a big fan. I've known Elliot for years. And when we were sitting in the meeting to sort of set this up, and we had done a very in-depth presentation, printed presentation, about all the kinds of things you didn't know that we thought we could tell, and all of the exclusive kind of archival. And Elliot said, I've wanted to tell this story for years and years and years. It was very moving when Ellen agreed to sit for this with her daughter. And I think in part it was because of her relationship with Elliot. She had remembered Elliot, and everyone had only the most wonderful things to think about Jennifer. And being a father, I remember at my dad's funeral, I gave a talk. And in the talk, I said, I wish I had been a parent before I was a child, because I would have understood how important and how special it is to be a parent. and nothing can ever replace a lost child. So this story has a lot of different facets that I think all of us can relate to, and I hope people really take it to heart.
I'm sure they will do, and thank you for making such a powerful docu-series that restores a narrative. And we always use a hashtag for the victims, and so we'll use the hashtag her name was Jennifer Levin, when we post this episode in memory of Jennifer. So thank you so much.
And thank you, all of you. It's been great speaking with you.
Thank you, Bobby.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Bobby. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203-866-4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.